Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 3, Ask Robin Black. I started the first one talking about something that I was nervous, to do this. I'm less nervous now. But let's keep that theme going, the idea of talking about something that you're scared of right off the top. I'm kind of scared of the questions today because, and I'm scared of the implication of the fact that we got 50 or 60 or 70 questions, which is awesome. Thank you. And so many of them are around, you know, the path of stars and how the UFC placed their stars and things like that. And that concerns me. Not, hey, ask anything you want. Literally anything. You ask questions, I will answer them. But it concerns me that we're so preoccupied with that kind of aspect of it. You know, how is the UFC going to promote this star? But I think it's as a result of Fox 22 that we just saw. We saw a lot of sort of young up-and-comers, and we saw a lot, you know, there's a real polish to these kids now, and I can call them kids. When you see, you know, America's Got Talent or something, and there's a bunch of, like, seven-year-olds doing, you know, breakdancing or something, and you're like, holy crap, are they ever good. And then they go up to talk, and they're just so seasoned, and they say all the right things. There's something in our culture where all of that is accelerating. So when you see these young, these Mickey Galls and Sage Northcutts and Paige Van Zants, there's this almost creepy sheen to them, and maybe that's what's making people see that. I don't know. But we're going to go forth, and we'll try to find ways to take these questions and deliver them back to what matters about fighting. But we'll get right into it. Chase is over on the board. Hi, Chase. Chase is smiling. You can't see him. I'm going to put up a GoPro at some point so you can see Chase. First question. There was like an opening sequence at the beginning. James made that. Takes about a month to put something like this together. You got to go. James will make the graphics and Matt, the web guy, will figure out how he's going to do stuff. But now we're doing it. And thanks for joining me. It's really fun. First question. Okay, Mike loves tacos. I love tacos too, Mike. Tacos are awesome. How many times did you cry/crap your pants during Swanson Choi? Was it your fight of the year? And was round two your round of the year? I like that we're going back to that. I do. It's something that I think about sometimes. I know I've talked about it before. Sometimes we just move on so fast. Right after the fight, the biggest question that you see asked in those scrums where all those guys are standing around holding that thing is, what's next for you? And it's like, man, I was just in this fight, this brilliant, difficult fight that my whole life has led to at this moment. Can I have this? You know? And everybody, what's next for you? Who are you going to fight next? Where does this put you in the division? Did you see my fight? The answer is I did cry a little bit. And I did actually, I got emotional watching it a fourth and a fifth and a sixth time this week because, you know, I've gotten to know both of these guys a little bit. They're two of my very favorites and they're so different than each other. And I knew they were going to bring something like that out of each other. I knew it going in. And they did, you know, and it was very special. Go watch it again. Watch it a few times. Watch it with music. Watch it silent and feel what was asked of them. The technique was amazing. You know, the dynamic of how they fought each other was incredible. But go in and look what they were asked to dig, where they were asked to dig from. You know, Du Ho Choi was hurt. Cub hit that guy so hard, and he just wouldn't give up. He wouldn't give an inch. He kept. But the thing is, there was the limits to what he can do. It's all predicated on a process in how he fights, and that process got interrupted by Cub. Greg Jackson told me a little bit about it. We talked a little bit about it before and after the interview. It was really fascinating. And then for Cub, he was dinged a couple times in the second round. And to see him just keep pushing and pushing, the desire to win, this is what he was put on earth to do, both of these two guys. Du Ho Choi is going to be a featherweight champion of the world one day, maybe before the end of 2018. And in our year-end show, they asked us to predict who all the champions. You can find it on YouTube, our YouTube channel. They asked us to predict who all the champions would be at this time next year, and I said it would be Cub Swanson, the featherweight champion. A lot of things always have to happen for that to happen. But a fight like that, to get that out of himself, he'll grow even further. So I didn't crap my pants, but I was chewing on something. Like when I was watching the first time, I had my book of notes, and I was back in the backstage, Kelvin Gastelum, a couple of his coaches, some other coaches, and I literally was chewing on it. There's chew marks on my notebook. Thank you for asking that question, because I really think a lot of the time we – these special things, these special moments in time when these guys are brought together and we forget about them a little bit. You know, a last thought I have on that before we move on. I was in Cuba and I made friends with a guy who worked at the resort. And so I met his family and I sent him music that he could later burn. He had a friend 2-hour drive away. He could burn CDs and resell them, which made his family some real money. And so when I came back, he invited me down and we sat down by the ocean and we were drinking rum and we were smoking these cigars. And we talked about smoking a cigar and how you've now decided to attach yourself to that hour and 15 minutes. And there's something about now, once you light it and you sit there, there's a meditative quality. You've chosen to sit now for that time we were talking. And as he was smoking it, you know, we were talking about how it tasted and we were talking, you know, about the cigar itself. But then he started talking about how when he looks at it burn, that he sits and he thinks about how long those leaves grew. You know, they were planted in the earth, this beautiful earth that Cuba has, which is partly why the cigars are so special and their fruit and vegetables are so good. It's the earth. It's never been treated with pesticides. There's never been pesticides on that island. So they're out of this beautiful earth and these plants grow and then eventually these leaves grow. And then while it's there, he thinks about the people. A lot of them are women, men and women, but he said he always imagined a woman, sitting there taking these leaves and rolling them by hand and how long it took for them to grow and be taken and crafted and rolled and all of the effort and energy and love that was put into them. And as he's sitting there smoking the cigar, and I'm smoking, I'm kind of drunk on rum too, and I'm just thinking, man, this guy needs a podcast. Actually, I wasn't thinking that. But you know, you're just sitting there looking at it and cherishing it, and suddenly it's all the more incredible because it isn't just a cigar. It is 8 or 10 people's efforts and a lifetime of them learning to do it and their hands and the love that they put into it, and all of a sudden that cigar is amazing. And we should look at fights like that. You know, Du Ho Choi, from the time he was a child, was created for that moment. Everything he studied and everything he did and everything he is, everything his parents taught him, the trials and the failures and the successes, and Cub Swanson through ups and downs of his life and everything he has studied and learned and prepared and grown as an artist and a human being, all of that comes to that moment, you know? And if you look at a fight like that, you see, it's much more, it's more alive. You know, there's much more life in it. And imagine if you could smoke a cigar while watching that, right? Okay, I'll move on. I get a little bit evangelical about fighting, and I am okay with that. I feel good about it. It makes me happy, you know? Okay, the second question. What did you learn, enjoy during your experience as an MMA fighter? Okay, Retro 442. Would you consider trying again? That's a whole podcast of its own. So my options here are either to get into one or two little details in depth or get a big general answer to that. And I think a kind of a general big picture answer is probably the best. You learn about yourself, right? I think fighting is one that we can all sort of understand. When we look at it, we see it's a test, right? It's a test. And you see that it's a test against another guy. But truly, when you do it, what you will find, especially in the early stages, I only fought 9 times and a couple of amateur this and matches that and smoker this. So, you know, less than a dozen times I fought and 9 times as a professional. So I don't know what happens when you get to a better stage than I reached. Will you get better as a fighter and a better mind, and so I don't know where that goes. But in where it went for me, the test is 100%, and this is not a cliche, or it is a cliche, but it is not only a cliche. You're fighting yourself. Every single second is a second that you can turn your back And our instinct, the first fight I had, I got spun around and I remember having my back turned and my brain, and I'm so happy I had this thought because I didn't always have it. I failed many times in many moments in fights. Is my brain said, you can't turn your back or they'll stop the fight. And I remember thinking that I had to move back towards it. And so there were good moments like that, moments where you learned that about yourself, that you understood those things. And then bad moments where you failed quite publicly. And there were a couple of times where mine was not like, well, you know, people say, oh, I just got caught. I was doing my thing, whatever. Nah, I failed, you know. And those are hard. Those are hard. But you... Failure is something – I talked with Rogan about this, actually. One of the very first times I ever talked about it was on his podcast. But failure is really important. You have to experience it because when you have failed to the degree that I did where, you know, you've turtled up in a fight where I couldn't see and I don't know what had happened to my vision, but you still say to yourself, Uriah Faber fought with two broken hands. Well, you're not Uriah Faber. You failed. And then people are booing, and then I'm being taken out on a stretcher, and you're so embarrassed, and you're so, you know, the next day who you are is different. But what you do discover is life goes on, and that's the lesson that's there. When you learn how to fail or be, you know, made fun of or be publicly ridiculed or feel just that. Once you experience that, it's horrible. I mean, it will always be horrible, but you realize that your life carries on. You'll do many other great things in your life. You'll learn from those things. And that makes you slightly less afraid to fail. And the fear of failure is the main thing that stops people from doing anything. Because what's the best, you know, what's the surefire way to not fail? Don't try. And failure is painful, but it is not the end of your life. And in failing, you learn something that will create some success later. If I didn't have those experiences, the losses and the times where I thought I was more than I was and it turned out the curtains pulled back and you're only this today, that allows you to study yourself, to grow, to make improvements so that you may not ever be lucky enough to be back in that situation. But if you were, maybe now you have grown in such a way that you can deal with it. That can't happen without the failure. And the failure can't happen if you don't try. So I think the failures were some of the best things. It's also your ego is a real danger to you. You know, all of our egos is incredibly dangerous to us. And our egos are illusions that we have of ourselves. And it's important to have some of those taken away. You can keep an illusion that you would be the guy to run into a burning house and save that baby if you never have to run into a burning house and save that baby. You can always have it, I could be that kind of guy. Then there's a burning house. You don't run in there. That illusion is no longer able to be there. And so when you put yourself out, you shatter some of those illusions you have about yourself, but that's a very important part to growing. And would I consider trying again? Yes. It's probably not going to happen, but I won 4 times and I lost 5 times in 9 fights, and 10 fights would be pretty cool. And I mean, whether I win or lose another one, to have about as many losses as wins, or maybe even an extra loss or two, to me, that feels like a pretty good analyst record. You know what I mean? You have to lose to understand fighting. You have to fail. You have to, you don't want to do any of these things. Trust me, it's incredibly painful, personally, very emotionally painful, but you have to. Chuck Liddell, I don't think, would be a very good MMA analyst. Sorry, Chuck. Because in Chuck Liddell's mind, he looks and goes, well, I don't know why this guy just doesn't go in there and hit him. Because Chuck Liddell was able to be special enough that he can't understand what it's like to be a normal human in a fight. I can. I'm a regular guy who tried my best. But I would love to do it one more time. It would definitely would have to be somebody 35 or older who's not as good as me. And I like 140 pounds. And I mean, like somebody else with a losing record who's not all that good probably won't happen. If it were to ever happen, it would be during a period where my wife has a contract where she's away for months at a time, because it's an incredibly selfish thing to live your entire life around a night 8 or 10 Saturdays from now. Every single choice in your life becomes single-minded. And that is that's one of the addictive natures why people keep fighting, is they have that thing and it gives them a purpose. I think on some level, I don't know BJ Penn personally, but on some level I see that in him. That when he has a purpose like that, his life makes more sense to him. I could be projecting that on him, and I probably am. We'll move on. Thank you for your question, though. Even with the failures and the setbacks, and that I really wasn't that good of a fighter, I had really good moments where I had to overcome things, and I did. And I understand it in a way. I understand the hard aspects of fighting. I see people analyze fights and who don't fight. Maybe they've sparred. It's not the same. If you can't, you have to personally understand the weight of the consequences and the people and the audience and the fact that you will forever be judged for the moments that you will put forth tonight. Now, you don't want that to exist when you fight, but it's real. It exists in the coming up and it exists after, you know. And if you don't have that, you can't – a lot of analysis is – and that goes for me. That goes for Dan. That goes for Jack, but a lot of this is what we think we see or what we believe is happening, but that is not what is necessarily happening. A lot of it is what's happening inside the mind of the fighter himself, and a lot of that can only be experienced by fighting. So I do what I truly love to do now, and I would never have been able to do that had I not fought. And I certainly wouldn't be as good as whatever amount of skill I have in doing it. I'm hoping to have way more in the future, but whatever I have, I couldn't have done it without those fights, and I couldn't have done it without those losses and wins. Okay, number three, Sexy Panda. At Sexy Panda, cheers to that. I don't know why that we would cheers that. I guess pandas are pretty sexy. Would you feel – oh, yeah, okay. So this is interesting to me. I'll let the – we have a saying in television that came from Glenn McDonald, our producer. We'll let the audience be the judge of that. Would you fill the slot of Goldie in the commentary team, and is that something you would be open to? Okay, a couple things about this. Goldie is not going anywhere. I don't know where anybody got that. So if Dana says, I got this idea of a dream team – do you really think that he's publicly saying, I'm getting rid of this guy? Like if you're – I mean, Goldberg at some point saw him and he's like, don't worry, Mike. You know, you're going to work with Brian Stan. I'm sure you'll work with Joe. It's just something we're playing around with. Like people leap to these enormous conclusions when people say things. Dana said there was somebody out there he'd love to pair with Joe. That has barely anything to do with Mike having a job. It has to do with Mike not being with Joe sometime. So Mike's not going anywhere. So let's put a stop to that craziness. But to really understand why I can say that is – and I talked about this a little bit in episode one – is whatever it is you do, there's a lot of things you have to learn about to really be able to do it. And one of them, if I want to – I do some work for the UFC in a variety of different pieces here and there. I work here for Fight Network. I'm small. Fight Network is a small company that was growing to a medium-sized company. You have to understand how that thing works if you're going to work in it. And then when I was brought in to do some things for the UFC, and I'll be doing some things for them again, they're a big company that's changing. You have to understand how companies work. And so – when I got brought in, Joe called Dana, who called Craig Borsari and said, bring him to Vegas, let's meet him. And I had a long meeting with them about different ways that I could add things, and I'm meeting with them again in January. And one of the things, this was awesome. So in the conversation, me and Dana are getting up and acting stuff out because the guy fucking loves fighting, okay? And so he turns. They said, "Okay, we're going to get you doing some breakdowns for the website, and we'll try to find other places. Be patient." And then Dana goes, "I want to try him on commentary." And you're like, "My heart's like this." We're like, "Right away," like, because you know, I'm just invited there. This I don't get to say, "Hey, by the way, you know that company you've been running for 20 years? Like, try me." Like, I don't get to do that. Nobody gets to do that in any job ever. And don't ever try doing that in the job. So he goes, "Yeah, and I want to try him on commentary." And I was just stoked. And I knew right away, instinctively, by understanding how their system works, that that would mean something on Fight Pass, not UFC related. Because they're not just going to drop anybody in on a live five-hour show with, you know, potentially millions of people watching, just in case that guy has, you know, a drug problem or like a stress, folds under stress. They have to get to know you. That's how companies, large companies of any kind work. So then I went into Shooto Brazil. I talked about this on the first one, and I did a bunch of those. And so I did pretty well, which would lead you in potentially into the stream. Dominic did those before he went into the Europe, but that doesn't exist now. But what I was getting at was not, you know, could I do it? I don't think I'm at a point where they know me well enough to know whether I could do it or not. So that would be something in the future. The point is that if you understand how this works, there are levels. So it's not like, you know, hey, if Joe Rogan leaves, who's going to be his replacement? Brian Stan's going to be his replacement. That's how that works. They go up, Brian Stan would go. If Joe were to go off and do his fight companions and do comedy and do all the other things he loves doing, and one day he will, Brian goes. And then whoever is under Kenny, Dan, Dominic, whoever, they go there and the bottom becomes available. If ever a spot is going to open up, whether whoever is going to go in there, it's like, hey, we got a show in Macau on Fight Pass and you want to do it? That's how that goes. You don't go up here. And it's the same thing. Goldie, who was working with Brian just last night, in fact, if somebody were to be brought in, there would be a slight adjustment. So in other words, there is no replacement other than if there's one person in particular that Dana would like, that guy's already being talked to. And then the other aspect is I'm not a play-by-play guy. I'm an analyst and color commentator. If somebody in some situation said, holy crap, we need you to do play-by-play, I would learn it and it would be anyone can learn anything and you can learn to do anything you want to do with enough work. But personally, I like doing analysis. So I'm sorry I probably didn't answer that very well. But Goldie's not going anywhere. He'll be working with Brian and probably Joe as well. Number four. Okay. Do you get tired of fight hype? And do we really need bad blood or a Twitter beef to enjoy a fight? I think somebody's trolling me because if you know me, you know that I'm not for that very much. Why? I had a couple books out here last time, and maybe I'll try to recommend some books at different times when we're hanging out. And this is one that I really like called Deep Work, Cal Newport. Okay, so there's a lot of aspects to this book. It's very good. About if you find something that you love doing, and there's a sacredness to the work. And I think of my deep work, it's art for a lot of people. My art is breakdowns. So I will immerse myself in that. We'll consider that deep work, okay? And that is you're going to take your focus to such a degree that you'll lose track of time. There's a certain enjoyment that you can have to it. You're pushing yourself right to the limits of your capabilities. You can enter a flow state if you're doing work or art or creating something that you love. And that's a very desirable thing for a lot of reasons. One, it's pleasant and you are actualizing yourself. You're making something that really matters to you and that makes you a happier person. So that's one. But then there's also a business aspect. So what is the opposite of deep work is shallow work. So I cannot work on a breakdown to any extent. It doesn't have to be work. There are people who play a video game that's a problem-solving video game where 6 hours fly by and they're hyper-focused. So if you're one of those guys or whatever that thing is for you, you know you can't be on Twitter. You know you cannot be on Facebook, Instagram. You can't be checking emails while you do that, or you lose the depth, okay? So when I go to do breakdowns, I'll book off 3 to 4 hour spots where nothing else exists. There will be no other windows open. There'll be nothing but that. And it's a very pleasant thing. If you don't have something like that, start trying to find it. People find that in playing piano. People find that in different kinds of art. People, some people find that in watching things. I get that almost every Saturday night. I feel that way. So it's something, it's very desirable. What stops you from that is shallow work. That is sending emails within your company, CCing something too that isn't that important about another meeting in 2 weeks, or, you know, cutting and pasting something from the internet to send it. The regular shit that we all have to do at work, the nature of how our work has evolved, it was once that was, 10% of your day. Now it could be 60, 70%. And we multitask. So we multitask is doing a whole bunch of tasks, none of them quite as well at all. So you cannot do deep work while checking Twitter, email, any of these things. Now, I know this is – I am going a long way from your question of Twitter beefs, but it is these types of things that get in the way of anything of depth in society, right? I'm not saying get off Twitter and Facebook, but it is a very good option. I have to do it for work. Now I've tried to find ways to just schedule it in the day. So from 4 to 5, I will be on Twitter. At different periods, I will be on Twitter. It's going to be part of my job. It's how we are doing this. And I like to talk to people. But if I do it all day, if I talk to people all day, I will not be able to do my work. So just the – and why is deep work valuable? Because it's so hard to do now. In a world where everybody's doing shallow work all day long, clicking on an email and opening Twitter and refreshing a page, and we all do it. You got to get away from doing that because it prevents you from doing anything of depth or deep consequence. If that's true of all of us, that means if you can find time to carve off four-hour chunks of true depth, real work, you're scarce, and scarcity has value. You're doing something valuable because it's really hard to do now. So I think any amount of – and so if we take that between work, deep – meaningful work and shallow work that is meaningless and it's mostly about novel experiences every few seconds, and we compare that now, bring that over to fighting, the fight itself, the moments within the cage, what they're experiencing, what we're seeing, that we can look at with depth, who they called out or what they said about the person's mother. But if we're concentrating on that so much, much the way that shallow work interferes with your ability to do deep work, shallow consumption interferes with your ability to consume it deep. There are incredible things about fights. There are incredible moments within there. There's things that happen with people's minds, perception, emotion, technique, physical things, heart and desire and growth and evolution, and all of these things happen in a fight. But we won't be able to consume that if we keep refreshing MMA fighting or MMA junkie or sure dog or whatever. And, oh, my God, I can't believe that guy said that. Hey, guys, did you hear what Cody Garbrandt said? If we do that – and there are people out there. And Mike Chiappetta, for example, is a very – I like Mike Chiappetta. I like his writing. He's very good at what he does. And at one point when I was saying this, Mike, who I respect very much, was like, Robin, I disagree. I think this kind of thing promotes – people to care about these fighters. And I think that is no longer true. I think that if it was true, or if it is sometimes true, what happens is it causes you to only focus on that. There are so – like the questions I kept getting related to this fight card were all about, what are – oh, the UFC star train got derailed. Like, who gives a fuck, Why are you focusing on this? Are you in the – do you have – if you have a fascination on how media and corporations use the media for the purposes of creating an artificial star, power to you. If that is where your interest lies, I don't know why you're at fighting, because you can go and observe that in music. You can observe that anywhere. But – we are distracted by these because of the speed at which our culture and the way that we consume things. We are distracted by small, meaningless things. Who cares what these guys say? most of the time what they are saying is just for the purpose of getting you entangled in it. And that is some indirect way to make you spend $69, and that's cool. But in doing so, your wavelength is limited. There's only so much brain power we all have. And whatever amount of chunk of it is used on these meaningless things is a chunk we cannot focus on something else. Whether that be, and you don't have to see fighting the way I see it. You don't have to. There's no, I mean, that's just my perspective. But I know there's something there. If instead of go, oh my God, did you hear what he said after the fight? I'm telling you, man, Monday, go look around. They're all going to be quotes about what Mickey Gall said and about what Dan Hardy said in return and about what Paige said and about what Karate Hottie's daughter said. And then somebody will go, oh, and she got the rear naked choke and she went out. Or he landed a right hand and then he got the... They'll just say what happened and then we'll get to the important business of talking about what they said. And I just don't think it should be that. I don't think it needs to be that way. I think we got distracted. I think it's the low-hanging fruit for media. Most large quantities of people who love to report on things will go for the easy low-hanging fruit. And this stuff, we're all responsible because if we click it, we've told them to do more of it. Anyways, I've digressed. I don't mean to be critical. I'm trying not to be so critical of things like that because we can do whatever we want. But sometimes, do you really want to eat Doritos or did the commercial tell you? And you were thinking you'd only have a few, but you ate the whole bag. You didn't want to eat the whole bag. You just did. That's something out there that has taken in a laboratory and figured out what will make you eat the rest of those Doritos. There's algorithms that take place to figure out what the bliss point is and so forth. Now you ate the whole fucking bag. And it's the same thing with media. Media is presented and gossip, what somebody said, the opinion of one person on the other that may or may not be based in reality is gossip. We learn it from the time we're young when we see our parents talking about other people that some of whom they don't even know. Oh my God, look at her nose, it's white. We see it from the time we're young, and it is one of the most, used forms of communication in our culture. And if you'll notice it and you start to pick up on it and you clue in on that, then you start to notice, and then you try not to do it. And you should try, and I try not to do it, but I do it. We all do. We're all victims of it. But if you're aware of it at least and you start thinking maybe there is something more than that, and that's the start. And we're imperfect right now. I'm probably gossiping right now in some indirect way that I don't mean to. But if you're aware of it at least, you can do something about it. While we're on that topic, does everyone realize from Out of Your Element, does everyone realize how smart Dominic Cruz is at the fight game? All-time great and has ability to talk circles around Cody. Now, this one is where talking and fighting meet. And there are places where they meet. Communication, language, cup, pen. These are all just words we gave things to create a language. Use of that language has combat purposes. Most of the time, it's not used that way, but sometimes it does. Dom is really fucking smart. Dom is really, really, really smart. He wasn't born smart. He's just seeking knowledge all the time. Nobody was born smart. We were all just babies. We couldn't do anything. And we learned things. We compiled knowledge and we gathered knowledge. Some of us stop after grade 12 or college or whatever, and some of us, others don't. They keep gaining knowledge, and Dom's one of those. And if you want to learn something, take something away by watching these guys, take that away. Go talk to Dominic Cruz 7 years ago and Dominic Cruz now and compare them. I didn't know Dom 7 years ago, but I can tell you, and he would tell you, that guy didn't know. He has built so much knowledge from that point based on the knowledge he had then, kept an open mind and changed and so forth. We're bringing this, somebody, about the talking between he and Cody Garbrandt, I assume, on television. In some of these moments, guys like Dominic, people like Connor, even the Diaz brothers, there are people who do use this talk, this language, the symbols that we say, as tools for fighting. And so they're universally saying, well, what they say doesn't matter is not true, but it rarely matters. And just because occasionally a conversation will have something to do with combat between them, as in this case, doesn't mean we should hang on every word. So that's the trick. When I was saying get off Facebook, you might say, well, but, you know, Facebook has value. It does, but that doesn't mean you should use it all day, every day. And does the words that fighters say sometimes mean something? Yes, but it doesn't mean we should obsess over them. Let's try to take this to somewhere that's where we can look into something. The confidence of Dominic and the confidence of Cody Garbrandt. When there are different types of confidence, and confidence is not a either on or off. It's not binary. You don't either have it or you don't have it. It is a living, moving thing. And I just read a book called The Four Agreements. My friend Tracy Trudeau introduced me to it. And there's another one called The Fifth Agreement, which comes after it. And it has some of these concepts about language and how we communicate and what words do and don't do. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant book. And so in the fifth agreement, there is an idea about our own perspective. So bear with me here. If we walk together into a movie theater, let's say there are hundreds and hundreds of movie theaters all next to each other, and we walk into one and we look, and there's a guy sitting down. He doesn't see us because he's so busy watching the movie. And in it is Cody Garbrandt. And Cody Garbrandt is big and powerful, and everything he does is great, and he's confident, and he's seeing this movie and this path of just laying out Dominic Cruz, and he trains harder than anybody else, and he is, you know, and when he's looking at that movie, he's watching it, it's his movie, and he's like, yeah, this is it, this is reality. If Cody Garbrandt then gets out of that movie theater and he goes into the next movie theater, and there's a woman sitting there. It's his mother, let's say it's his father sitting there. And he looks on the screen, and his father looks different, and he looks different. He's like, he's a little boy, and, you know, he needs to be taken care of, and all of these different things. He's like, that's not me. And he realizes he's seeing the world through his father's eyes. His father is different. And he's like, that's not my dad. But that's how his dad sees himself. And he walks into Dominic Cruz's movie. And Dominic Cruz is sitting there. And in Dom's movie, Dom is hardworking, striving. And he sees himself in there. And he's this skinny little kid who has no real, you know, ability. He's never really done much. He's a serious threat, one to be taken seriously. But he's weaker and smaller. And he's like, that's not me. And in Dom's movie, Dom is faster. And each of these movie theaters is your perspective. And if he walks into my movie theater, I see him the way that I see him, as this incredible young talent. Maybe I watch the way his feet move and I contextualize it against Dominic Cruz, and I see that it's going to be tricky for him to get Dominic. And he's like, that movie's wrong. But each of these movies is how we see things. There's a universe in your head. There's a universe in your head. Chase's movie is very different than mine. In Chase's movie, I'm a goofy, dorky guy with a crazy shirt on who talks really fast about weird fight stuff. And in my movie, I'm wearing a tuxedo and I've got a dry martini. You know, we all are seeing stuff. But the truth, and here's the ultimate thing, that the truth doesn't matter what you see. The truth is the truth regardless of what you see. Gravity doesn't care if you believe in gravity, but if I do this, gravity is there. It doesn't care if I believe in it, and the truth doesn't care either. So the truth is the truth. However, if Cody Garbrandt takes certain actions because he believes his is true, he will act in the way that he believes it to be true. And the truth will unfold the way it unfolds. So sometimes your belief, your self-belief, drives you into a certain situation, maybe in such a way that you ignore some of the threats that would be there, which will result in you winning. So that's the accidental successes of confidence. You just, before you know it, you come ripping out there immune to the realities of the threats because you feel so powerful and it works. Or you come out there immune to it and you're unconscious in 12 seconds or 13 seconds, or, you know, you don't get to write it. The truth is the truth, and that's why we got to watch it. That's why whatever they say, you can get an insight into, and maybe Dom saying something might make that movie when Cody Garbrandt's watching that movie and he's thinking, you know, whether or not he can take a shot. If that affects his movie and how he sees the world and the universe in his mind, that can have an influence. So in those little ways, when used like that, you can use these things as a tool. And Dominic is smart enough to use these things as a tool. I don't think that Cody Garbrandt has necessarily the skills to beat Dominic Cruz yet. But it doesn't matter what I think. If he believes he does and he accelerates off that line with full, true commitment, going for that chin, it's possible he can get it, you know? But Dominic Cruz, you don't have to be around him for very long to see how smart he is and to see how he's learning. And he knows everything that's going on around him. And I look up to Dominic Cruz a great deal when I see somebody capable of becoming the world champion and then becoming one of the very best at the job he does when he wears a suit and tie. And then, you know, all of these things, understanding the mind the way he understands it. Does that mean he will win this fight? Not necessarily. But does it mean that he'll probably win this fight? Yeah, it does. He's an incredible man, though. He's an incredible young dude when you stand back and watch him and I mean in the cage, but outside of it as well. It's very, very interesting. Okay, let's keep going. How much time have we spent, Chase?
40 minutes.
40 minutes. That's crazy. Thank you for sticking with me if you have. If you haven't, then I'm speaking not to you, so you don't know. How does a champion keep the contender's mindset in order to not become overconfident? Yeah, I love that question. You know what I love most about it? The how. Right? Now we're thinking. Because just saying what it is, I don't think is deep enough analysis anymore for us. I think we know enough now that that's not going to do it. You know, there's a big right hand. I think we can do better. What it is, now we've seen it. A lot of us know it. It's a head kick. Okay, we know. Why? How? That's the next layer. That's the next layer. Because when you look at, you know, Anderson Silva or George St. Pierre or Jose Aldo when he was on his run or Demetrius now, and you say, what does this guy got to do to keep winning? Oh, man, he's got to keep that contender's mindset. No shit. You know? No shit. How does he keep that contender's mindset? Now we're thinking. And the answer to that is, I think, beyond what we're qualified to talk about. So all we can do is think about it. We can talk it out a little bit and see how it might apply to us, how in our what we do, how we can connect in our own life a way that might give us some insight into this. I think among the things you need to do to keep this, so let's take this away. Are we qualified to comment on Demetrius Johnson? We're not sure if we are. Are we qualified to comment on ourselves? I think we are. So whatever it is you do and you want to stay hungry, you want to keep growing, you want to keep learning, that you have to do that. That is what it is to be alive. We often see people that are very, very rich. They're worth $100 million and they're miserable. And they said to themselves, when I make my $1 million, I'll be happy. Then they made their $1 million. They're happy for a week. And then a little while later, they went back to normal. It's called the hedonic treadmill. You know, you stay in place. Your happiness level stays in place. So then they're a couple months later, they're bored and they're a millionaire now and it didn't work. So what that should teach you is that money will not make me happy, but for some weird reason, then the person will say, well, when I make 10 million, I'll be happy. Now think of that for just a moment. That doesn't make any sense. Getting money didn't make you happy. So your answer is get more money? Doesn't make any sense. None at all. Then they get 10 million. It doesn't do it. Well, when I have 100 million, this is not going to work. This is not going to work, right? And people do it with things. Oh, man, when I get a new car, I'm going to be happy. And you get a new car and you're not happy. Well, maybe if I had another car. Doesn't make any sense. We just learned that getting things doesn't make you happy. What makes you happy is progressing, growing, learning. That's if you are people think if I'm successful, I'll be happy. That is, if I only one of the nonsensical things that I ever say, if you ever hang out with me in this podcast, if only one of them you take, please take this one. People say, if I'm successful, I'll be happy. Bullshit. If I'm happy, I'll be successful. That's a fact. If I'm happy, I'll be successful. If I'm successful, I'll just be successful. Happiness is a separate thing. Happiness comes from learning things, growing to your potential, having great relationships, trying to get better every day, doing your best always, being challenged. That makes you happy. I'm happy. You know? I know. And I did purposefully sought it out. So this is what you're supposed to be doing, is going and growing and learning. That's what we're doing here. So how do we do that? If we figure out how we do that, logically that can be applied to Demetrius Johnson and how he keeps doing that. And because in the end, hungry contender's mindset is just three words made up of a number of symbols that we put together and applied a meaning to it. What does it really mean? It means continuing to grow, continuing to seek mastery, continuing to push beyond that. So how can we all do that? So let's figure that out. What do we need to do that? Well, we need to be challenged. Okay, Demetrius is challenged. That's no problem. We need mentors. We need mentors for sure. So he has Matt and others. And then we need the truth, as much of the truth as we can get. So personally, I think it's really important to have a few people around you that you trust. Matt is a genius. Matt Hume, Demetrius is Johnson. Demetrius is coach. Demetrius is Johnson. That's a really bad movie. It's like a porn. I mean, he's just playing video games. It's not, I don't even know where I'm going with this. This whole train of thought thing, which is how this podcast, I think, works, it can really betray you in moments like this. Demetrius is Johnson. Sorry. So Matt is someone he trusts and, of course, brilliant. But I think in our lives, we need to have people that we really trust to give us the straight goods, who are also growing. And we'll help them and they'll help us. So I have two good friends. Evan Boris is a kickboxing coach and a friend. He was in my wedding party. I have a few key friends, small collection of good friends. And then Marc-Andre Drolet, who lives in Winnipeg. And he helped book my fights when I used to fight. And he was the best man at my wedding. And so these guys give it to me straight. And I give it to them straight. And you need to have that. And I think you need to constantly be studying yourself. You, with the help of these people, you need to constantly study yourself, prioritize things, and understand, know where you're going. If you're Demetrius, because, and I've talked about this a bit recently, Misha Tate was a victim. She never recovered from that win. Do you know what I mean? She never recovered from that win. She won the title, and she never recovered because there was nowhere. She didn't know where to go next. She didn't have a new goal. The new goal was to be greater than she'd ever been before. She was now the champion, and through some understanding of how she phrased and viewed that, the champion travels around the world looking beautiful or handsome if it's a guy, well-dressed, well-spoken, as an ambassador to the sport. She took that role. And in taking that role, she was not hungry. She said, oh, I'm not motivated to win this fight. Well, you have that in your control. That you're not a victim of that. But she didn't, and this is not a criticism. I love Misha. She's so beautiful too. Again, with the train of thought thing. She just didn't know where to go. She didn't set a new thing. She never set new goals. She never studied herself. She took the role of right now, travel around the world, being a great ambassador, doing a bunch of interviews, and not how do I motivate myself? What am I about? What else am I seeking? Because on some level, she got there. She did what she set out to do, and we're good. You know, so it's really up to the individual. A couple of key people, some training and self-study. Understanding the truth is the first step to self-mastery. You know, understanding the reality and where are you and where are you looking to go and what will that require, and be honest about it. Am I going to do those things? Yes, I am. Am I going to do them to the best of my ability? Yes, I am. Okay, you're good. You're good, Demetrius. Then the next guy, and then the next fight. And now what am I after? Now I want to prove that there have never been better. Now I want to get the short conversations I've had with Matt Hume, it's just a path to mastery. That's what they're doing. all this other stuff, whatever. It's not, it doesn't have to enter it. We're on a path to mastery. And that's what you have to keep. Given the direction the UFC is headed in, is Mike Perry's character the blueprint for success in the sport's future? You'll see, now you see, I'm trying to take these back to fighting as best, you know, the fights themselves, but this show was a lot about stars and star power and words and a lot less about fighting. And let's just be aware of that. I'm trying to say that without any judgment, because it's wrong for me to judge what somebody else loves or finds interesting or is a victim of. Because on some level, you know, like I said with the Doritos, you don't necessarily, you're not going through the world making these choices sometimes. They're being made for you. So this will be the way I can answer this the quickest. And did I talk about the Beatles last time, Chase? I don't think so. You know, the Beatles, I know I'm old, but they had bowl cuts and they wore suits and they sung I Want to Hold Your Hand. They're old people music, but the world was what it was. And I just told this story on a friend's podcast yesterday. That's why it popped into my mind. All of a sudden, the Beatles come along, and they're the biggest fucking thing that has ever existed, ever, at the time. And why? Because they were different. They were different. They had this authenticity. They were unique. Unique, that's what it was. They were unique. They all dressed in suits together, and they all had the same haircut. But that was unique. And they sung a certain kind of pop, and it was unique. And they were playful, and they were real, and they had a real way. That was all unique. So they were big because they were unique. And then every other band was like, how do we? And they just copied them exactly. If you look for the next 5 years, every band was wearing the same suit and the same helmet bowl cut, which were goofy, by the way. How the fuck you get from looking at uniqueness and seeing the success of uniqueness and thinking that the answer is to copy it, I don't have a clue how or why we do that. But we as people do that a lot. And it makes some sense. If you look at primates and they take that stick and they put it down into that ant hole and then they eat all those ants, which I'd like to try. I'm not going to eat the ants, but I'm curious if I can see, you know, a primate doing that, I should be able to do that. Okay, I think I just answered it. See how I wanted to try that? I saw it and I wanted to try it. There's aspects of our brains called mirror neurons, and I'm studying that a fair bit right now, and we'll talk about a lot more in the future as to how that applies to fighting. But mirror neurons, if I throw a low kick at you, what do you often do? You throw a low kick back at me. That is habit. That is monkey see, monkey do, which is what we're talking about with the ants. And that is connected to our brain, and it's something called mirror neurons, and we've always done that. But if I want you to low kick me, why would I want you to low kick me? Well, among the counters is a straight right hand. I'd love it if you low kick me because I'm ready with a straight right hand, and I notice that your left hand is down here and you're flat-footed when you throw a low kick flat on your back leg, so you don't really move, so you're going to be in range, you're going to be there, your hand isn't there, I can land my right hand on you. If only I could find a way to make you kick, I'm ready to do it. Kick you. Good chance you'll kick me back. If you don't this time, you might next time. And that aspect of the game, being able to, sometimes I can predict what you're doing, or you can predict what I'm doing, and other times, why can you predict what I'm doing? Because you make me do it, right? So anyways, that's how we brought it back to fighting. But the long and the short, the Beatles, monkeys with sticks, kick to kick, all of that is don't fucking imitate anybody. Don't imitate anybody. I know you can't help it sometimes. And when people do commentary, for example, it is very hard not to use Roganisms. Joe has been the voice that we've heard for our life, for the life of watching mixed martial arts. Now, you know, those first bunch that we watched, that wasn't Joe, but when we think of fighting, we hear Joe. And that is so cool. And it's so cool for Joe. I don't know if he knows how cool that is. I think he does. But just to think, like, what you're kind of, on some level, among the things that we're doing here, You know, we're trying to get better. We're striving. We're learning. We're also hoping, if we have something good, that we're putting small bits of influence into the world. If you've got a good idea and you're pretty sure it's a good idea, what if you could share it? And then other good ideas come, which is also why I hate the Twitter beefs. I think those gossip and things like that are poison. And I think the more we see it, the more we imitate it. And then now, you know, if the president of the United States can publicly ridicule a reporter and we're all kind of cool with it, then you see where it's gone. You see where the poison has traveled, right? And it's getting to all of us, and we're all doing it, you know. Even when you're consciously not trying to do it, and I am consciously trying not to do that, and I do it, and I wish I didn't, and I'm sad when I do it, but that's how hard it is to resist. So we do that, but don't copy anybody. So is Platinum Perry, is he the... the blueprint? No, the only reason he's interesting is because he's unique. Don't imitate Connor if you're a young fighter. Don't imitate anybody. I know that, like I said, I went on a tangent, it is very hard not to, but if you're conscious of it, then that's the start. That's the start of everything. If we're, most of these conversations that I've had by myself here, I'm glad you're with me, thank you, it has been that. It's like if you're aware of it, then you have a chance to go learn about it. And learn about it about yourself. So you're aware that you don't want to imitate. You want to innovate. Imitation. And we applaud imitation often, you know. But just try not to do it. And your life will be better if you don't. Okay. We got a few more. I know we're going for a while. I hope if you're still with me. I don't know why I say that. Because if you're watching this, you are still with me. Thank you. It's really cool. This is really fun. Sundays. We're trying to do this on Sundays. But I think Chase and I are going to maybe do the 31st. No promises. I haven't 100% confirmed with Chase. He has a life, you know. And on the 31st, which would actually be a Saturday. But it's the day after Ronda's return. And Dominic, I fucking love watching Dominic Cruz fight, man. I met Dominic Cruz a couple times. I was down at Fox meeting with people down there about maybe contributing something one day, and I was super quiet, which I never am, but I was like, I kind of felt like the, you know, when I go into somebody else's gym, you know, I'm quiet. It's their gym, man. Like, I'm a guest here. And Dom and Dan was there, Cormier, and he is so loud and friendly, but Dom was really complimentary to me, which was very nice. I look up to him, both of those guys, a lot. I've done this longer than they have, and you see how good they are. And I know how hard it is to get that good, and those guys are fucking hard workers, man. Okay, so these can go together. 8A and 8B, but I'm sure we've added other questions that I've just hurled in. So my buddy, Klonsky MMA, David Klonsky, Dr. David Klonsky, he and I have been flirting with this idea of writing, we've decided to write a book together about the psychology of fighting. When we started the path a year and a half or more ago, we had these ideas of what we were going to do, and I'm glad we didn't do them because we know way more than we knew then. And that is a bit of a trick. And we have done a couple of podcasts together, he and I. And on some level, every time I think about it, the idea of podcasting and using that to flush out the ideas that then become the book might be the way to do it. But we'll see. Time is an issue. Dude's a psychology professor, and he has a kid. And I don't know. I'm here all day, every day. So. So he said, your best guess based on available data, how good is Mickey Gall? And somebody, Forkasun, said, what do you think Mickey Gall needs to be a top 10 fighter? Okay. Okay, the best available data so far, and obviously, dude's a psych professor. He phrased that perfectly because, you know, somebody, you go ask somebody who works, you know, in fighting, how good is Mickey Gall? And they'll tell you. And that's all just in their head. As is most things people tell you. It's all what's going on in our own heads. But we've got data. Or data. Which way? Data? Data? I like data. It sounds better. You should just use words however you want, as long as people understand them. I really, really mean that. You don't have to, You don't have to parrot things. So how good is Mickey Call? Okay, well, so he beat three guys who'd never fought anybody or never beat anybody. So that is fairly meaningless for anybody who has ever had a white belt come into the gym and you're like, man, it's crazy. But if you think of what fighting is, again, I'm on a tangent here, what jiu-jitsu in particular, if I do this to you, you do this. Okay, so that's what you do. Okay, so let's do something with that. Let's make that wrong. And then I do something else to you and you do this. Okay, cool, then I'll do that. You've reverse engineered it based on the reactions of people. When I push you, you give me your back. If you give me your back, I'll put my legs there. If I put my legs there, you don't know what to do. Put my arm there. It's normal. So until somebody knows what to do, it's very easy to beat them. He beat a couple of white belts, a guy who was 39 who trained hard and wanted to do it, but you can't learn to fight in that time. Not on any level. I know. Because I've trained. I started training old too, and I trained full time just like that. So that didn't show us much. And then this fight, he landed a punch if somebody's got underhooks on you and you overhook both of them, you're going to squeeze their arms in. So if I'm under you like this, and then somebody will apply pressure here, which really surprisingly hurts the shoulder. And from that, with a sort of a half of that, he jerked out and threw an overhand right. That's, I think, the only strike he landed in the whole fight. His striking looked fine. He's very green and very far from being a top 10 guy. He needs to do what everybody needs to do to be a top 10 guy, and that is constantly get better and keep improving, really understand himself, grow, take harder and harder and harder tests, and then keep going. But here we get this weird thing going on now where a guy who beat nobody of any consequence now is, like he said, I'm a marquee fight. That's weird. That's very strange. That's a sign of the times. And that isn't necessarily connected to his skill level. Sage Northcutt is a blue belt, I think. So we have a brown belt who beat a couple of white belts and then submitted a blue belt. So we don't really know, but, you know, this is what I do for a living for a decade now. And I look and he's not a top 20 guy currently. And neither should he be. Four fights in, it's amazing. Actually, it's quite amazing what he has done, and good for him. And parts of me is like that same thing if you were here at the beginning when I was saying you see these kids come out and they do hip-hop or whatever, and you're like, wow, are they ever good? And they say all the right stuff. He's got some of that, and that's weird. It seems weird to old people like me. Of an ancient generation. It just seems very strange that these young, you know how to do all that stuff. It's so normal. So kids have seen from the time they were little kids how to do TV. So he's good at that, and he's kind of handsome. He's kind of got like a Disney hero kind of look. But yeah, he's not all that good yet. Cool for him that he gets to do that. The scary part is, I'm sure, I don't know, it's Sunday today. You could be watching this on Monday or Tuesday or in a Thursday in March. That's how the internet works. If you are, cool, hey. I sure hope that Dan Hardy doesn't fight him. That is crazy. But again, if he's in his movie theater and he's watching the movie of his life, he's so good. And that's where it gets dangerous. That's where it gets dangerous. This guy should not be in there with Dan Hardy. Absolutely not. Nobody with one win over one guy who's kind of had an inflated, been brought along, who has never, you know, one win over a guy who has any wins should never be in there with Dan Hardy. Like, that shouldn't even be made. That's crazy. And I'm talking about Dan, what he was capable of. Since then, by him spending, I mean, this is not a coincidence. Daniel Cormier, UFC champion. Michael Bisping, UFC champion. Tyron Woodley, UFC champion. Dominic Cruz, UFC champion. All four of those guys have spent the last 3 or 4 years analyzing fighting. Is that a coincidence? It's not a fucking coincidence. You get so much better at it. This third-person perspective makes you so, you understand it on a level. There's no way that guy should be in there. Dan Hardy is lifetimes better than that guy. He is crazy. But in that movie of his life, he's seeing him and he has big muscles and he is smooth and just incredibly talented. And if there's people around him going, oh, Mickey, man, you kill that guy, you're doing a real disservice to this guy. He is not, he does not have an understanding of what Dan does and can do. And this is not meant to be critical. And I really hope it isn't coming out that way. I mean, I guess it is critical, but it isn't intended to be hurtful or rude. It is not. It is just the my movie. I'm watching it, and I'm sitting there, and I've dedicated my adult lifetime to analyzing this stuff. And when I see those two, and I know what growth Dan Hardy has had, I see how even just analyzing his thought process, this young man is not on that level. But when you get tangled up and we layer in this idea of how using words in between fights elevates your status and your position as a combat celebrity, that thing is not connected to skill. That is not. It is not connect. The illusion, you being a marquee fighter, you being on Fox, when it is a part of your charm and your looks and how well-spoken you are and the fact that you beat up a wrestler, a pro wrestler, and you were on a TV show, none of that has anything to do with fighting ability. Like Dave said, with the best available data, I saw a guy who cannot strike with Dan Hardy of 5 years ago at all. And presumably would start to panic when he started getting pieced up because he's never had that experience. So please don't let that fight happen. And I hope this isn't getting in Dan's way, because Dan might seriously be looking at that going, oh, you're kidding. Oh, man. Look, he wants a fight to come back into fighting. What would be better than a guy with four fights who's only beaten one guy who was a pretty developing level fighter? Oh, man, that's got to be tantalizing for Mr. Hardy. So I don't know by the time you're watching this where that goes, but if I was a commission, I am not sanctioning that fight. And again, please don't get me wrong. This is, I want nothing but for the best for this guy. And if he can win a few more fights, he will improve each time. But it's a weird thing, man. This is the first, this show that we just saw is the first one where this happens, you know, in music, the best singers and the best musicians did not become the biggest stars. They just didn't. Britney Spears is a star. And her voice is fine. It's good. And she dances very well. But she is not the best singer in the world. Now, in sport, that doesn't really happen. Dennis Rodman was a star, but the dude could, like, what did he do? Block shots? Yeah, rebounds. I'm looking to Chase for this. But he could actually do the thing. It is rare in any sport where you could, you know, maybe a team sport where, like, you're on the bench and we can put Diddy, you know, on the bench or whatever, but you can't, being a star has nothing to do with winning a fight. And so you can be a fan of Mickey Gall and be a fan of the things around that, and that's cool. I like him. He seems likable. But that doesn't have anything to do with the ability to fight. He is a young, developing fighter. And that is where he should be, and I hope that's where he will be. And if Dan wants to fight him, I'm not going to get in Dan's way. Dan's a good dude, and he's a friend, and I like him very much. But I don't think he should. I don't think anybody should make that fight. So follow up connected to that. Do you think Sage played into Mickey's hands, getting that emotional, and began brawling / lost his usual great stance / footwork? Yeah, I do. Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's very perceptive. I mean, good coaches you hear, and fighters later you hear them say, what happened? What happened in that fight? I fought out of character. What does that really mean? Because you can be a different character. Some nights you need – Cub Swanson against Duho Choi was a different Cub Swanson than he is on certain nights, you know? So there are things that you need to draw from. That character doesn't need to be set. You can be many things in fights. But fought out of the character that we needed that night, you know? I don't know what to say about Sage Northcutt. I don't know what to say about him. I met him and God, he's such a sweet dude. Like, you can see he's happy, but it seems strange. I feel something creepy there with the way that he's sheltered. He's like a man, you know, but he's sheltered and he's been kind of developed, you know. And I watched his father cornering him in a gym, and I feel like there's something that isn't kind of happening that would be good for him. I don't know. It's not my place to really say. I'll give it some more thought before I really kind of say what I think. But he seems like a really sweet dude. And when you watch what he is physically gifted and capable of doing, I don't think he's quite sure of who he is. And I think that is as a result of being led to be a certain thing. But we'll see. We'll think about that in the future. Okay, a couple more. Thanks for hanging in with me. Who were your mentors in life? Ask Robin Black. Oh. Mentors are really important. And I mentioned this on the first episode. I reached out to Matt Hume and asked him, because recently I've kind of felt maybe I don't have a mentor. And I know that I'm not going to be in a position right now to have one good mentor. People's lives are very busy. There's the odd person that comes to me and asks me for advice and, you know, that type of related thing, which I take as a very big compliment. And I try to help, but I know how busy I am. I know I can't always get back to them. There's a couple of people and people I like and hope that do well and will do well in the future. But I know how busy I am. I can't help them. So I know that, you know, I know that anybody I'm going to look to is going to be the same. I asked Joe Rogan for some mentorship. He's helped me in different ways. Brian Stan has been very kind and helped me. I called John Anik when I was doing some work, and I asked him for some advice. So little bits like that. Chael's been very, very helpful to me. So there's little bits like that. But currently, I don't really have a mentor. And I know I'm not probably likely to be fortunate enough in the short term to have one. But I think it's important to have mentoring in your life, very, very important. If there are masters out there and you're working towards mastery, if you have something you can give them, whether that just be, you know, friendship or support or some help of some kind, some menial tasks you can do for them, or sometimes they just appreciate having someone to bounce things off of, then you should find that. So I don't have that. So I reached out to Matt Hume recently and said, would it be okay if I came for like 10 days and just kind of shadowed you, watched you guys work and trained a little bit there and on my own. I don't think I would even bring a camera. I think I'd just go learn. I'd get a fresh perspective. And he said that maybe. He said, let's get through Christmas, and he's not opposed to the idea. If he then says, oh, I can't do it right now, then I'm just going to be polite and persistent, and I'm going to find something I could do that would be of benefit, of bring some value to him, until I can go and take 10 days or 2 weeks or something and learn some new ideas. And he's not the only one out there, but I really, there's something special going on there. And the old, his connection to the old is, you know, to Bruce Lee, his father studied under Bruce Lee, and being through so many eras and still being so on the front, his knowledge will have a historical context too. And I won't bother him. I'll just quietly watch, you know, and train a little and whatever. But so I've reached out in hopes of that. But in my life, I've had many that were really, really important people to me. Like I said, Joe, Anik as a broadcaster, Chael, and Chael is a misunderstood person. He's the sweetest guy going. And Brian Stan has been very helpful. People like that are very helpful at this stage of my life. I learned a lot from music producers. A lot. There were three key ones for me. A guy named Mo Berg, who he's in a band called The Pursuit of Happiness. And you can go look it up, The Pursuit of Happiness. And he was a very early music mentor. But we weren't – I wasn't just learning about music, I understand now. I was learning about work and how to develop art and how to, you know, react to situations and how to, you know, do deep work. Because it all carries over. It's, you know – trying to master one thing makes it easier to learn other things in your life. And then that brought me to a guy named Garth Richardson. His nickname is Garth, G-G-G-Arth, Garth, because he's got a stutter. And even that, to put that in your name like that shows you how to take something that is, you know, that other people would give them problems and to proudly wear it, you know? And I learned a lot from Garth. Garth was – so I was never a very great singer, but I didn't really let that stop me. As long as there was one other or two successful people that really didn't have a gift, Anthony Kiedis from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, that guy can't sing at all. And they're a very big band, so that told me it could be possible. But Garth went and you saw just how obsessive – to detail he was, and how, and so he first became known because the Rage Against the Machine had been recorded a number of times and never captured. So in Los Angeles, people would go to Rage Against the Machine concerts and their minds would be blown. The intensity and the savage, you know, the power of what they did. And then people recorded them and it didn't work. And then Garth got the sound. Garth figured out how to make Rage Against the Machine on record sound the way Rage Against the Machine sounded when you saw them. And so, and then he produced many other big things, but it was how meticulous, that's the word, how meticulous he was. And so I learned about that from him. And you know, he was a great father and a really kind man. And so that influenced me. And then he brought in a guy named Bob Ezrin. And Bob Ezrin produced Pink Floyd The Wall. He produced Kiss Destroyer. He produced, like, just look up his name. And so same thing. He was very successful. He was a very successful, very, you know, he would have lots of money and houses and stuff. But he was, again, and we were small. We were very small. Our band had one record, which we had sold 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 copies of in England and Canada. And he came to us and said, I'll make your record for free. I like you. And that gift, that doing that, and he and Garth both together worked on that. And they were going to get a percentage if and when we signed to a major label or we made lots of money. And they gave us a lot of time and a lot of work for a very small band because they believed in us. And I couldn't really sing, and they still believed in us, in what we had. And that was very touching. And that, too, both what those guys did with that, that was a type of mentoring too. Now I want to help somebody else if I can. Joe too. Joe called Dana and said, hire this guy. If I can ever do that for somebody, it makes you want to do that, you know? But there's been lots of people. It's really important, man. You got to have Mauro Ranallo, you know, on some levels gave me some mentoring. And when I started, Ramdeen, who's now a partner, he gave me some mentoring in the beginning too. Michael Chiavello, you know, I worked a few shows with him. He gave me a lot of very good advice. It's really important. It's really important. If you're looking for mastery, then you look to the masters, you know. Okay. At Pecking Claw. This is my buddy Pecker. And Pecker was a fighter, and he was a Team Tompkins guy out of London. He's a good dude. How do you fit that much handsome in those suits? I know why he's asking me that, because I told him my story about my suit. So I've got two really cool suits, really nice, really, really nice, that are David August's custom-made suits. So I told you that Joe called Dana. Dana talked to Craig Borsari and said, bring that guy down here. We want to meet with him, and we want to bring him on. And they talked to me about doing breakdowns for them and doing starting in some amounts of commentary or whatever. I'm meeting with them again in January. Hopefully, we're going to figure out how I can contribute in bigger ways. But we'll see. That's You can control what you can control, and that is go in there and let them see how much you've grown and how sturdy and stable you are after this much time of contributing in small ways, and you hope that you can do more. But so we have this great conversation, and they're like, you know, start by doing some breakdowns for, you know, Fight Pass and our .com, and we'll figure out other ways as you keep growing to use you. And plus, I work here. So that has to, you know, we find out how to make that balance. And there are things I can contribute from here that we build at Fight Network and do for them. So, and that's the ideal. That way I get to, you know, live in Toronto with my friends here as we build this thing and build something for the UFC from here. So that's the thing. Anyways, so the conversation goes really great. They said, we love to bring you on and et cetera, et cetera. And then Dana goes, by the way, we're going to set you up with a couple of suits, custom suits. And I'm like, cool, I've always wanted a custom suit. So I said, thank you. And when you see like Cody Garbrandt and Dominic Cruz on there, they're probably wearing David August suits too. And I'm telling you, these things are crazy nice. So the story that I'm trying to get to as I meander all over the place is they set it up via email where I'm in touch with somebody. And my guy there is named James, and he's like, you're a suit guy. And he's very cool. We're friends now. And so they sent two guys. I was in Vegas working. I think it was for the McGregor-Aldo fight. And they sent two guys to my hotel room. And they come over. And these two dudes are impeccably dressed. I mean, like $1 million. You know, $1,000 haircuts and $1 million suits. And they come in, and they're looking spiff-tastic. And they come in, and they meet me. And then they say, okay, well, we're going to take some measurements. I'm talking like 50, 80 measurements. You know, and there's like laser levels, like a level with like a laser in it. And they're like taking angles. One guy's taking it, dictating to the other guy who's like putting it all in. They videotaped me walking. Like, it was crazy. So then they go and they make custom suits. And inside, like my custom thing, is I've got skulls and crossbones inside. And they're nice, I'm telling you. So then they work on that. I don't know how many people work on it. It's like that cigar I was talking about. When you think about it, like how much effort was put into it, you're so grateful. So then James flies up to Toronto and then fits me. So now this is three people I've dealt with directly, plus whoever made that all by hand. Then he comes in and fits me, and then he stayed in Toronto for 2 days to like custom the last few bits. And they are spectacular. Now, and I mean, the shirt like fits you. Oh, you feel so great in these. And I have never had a lot of money, but I've always had enough. Like I've never, you know, to me, money is not super important. So, you know, I can always pay my bills on time and take my wife on a trip sometimes. And to me, I'm rich. I am rich. And I would have never like thought about, you know, you see these people that are millionaires and you think, you know, how money doesn't make you happy. We went over that. Things don't make you happy. We went over that. But now you see the difference of the things that they get. Now, the sad thing is, if you ever got to a point that three people made you a suit and it was so beautiful and so nice and it did nothing for you. Do you know what I mean? That's that treadmill. Like if every suit you had, everything was custom made by people, you'd be like, yeah, can you hurry it up? You know what I mean? That would be sad to me that you would ever get to a point that these things that are these special little things, that they would become normal. And I would really hate that. That would be sad. If you've ever been in first class, that one time where somehow you got upgraded by mistake or like you knew someone. Somebody did that once for me because they watched stuff that I did on TV. It was so nice. And I thought about it, I'm like, what if you did this all the time? Would this become your normal now? And that's a weird thought. You hope not. You hope people still appreciate these nice things. But if you're trying to be made happy with nice things, it's never going to work. But that man, those suits are nice. And David August, go on the website and check it out. Like they are hot, and he makes a lot. I think they were saying when Conor wins his fights, he usually orders like 40 or 50 of them. So it's a coincidence if you win. And, you know, sometimes you'll hear Conor say, oh, they're all dressing like me. Well, they all get custom suits from the same place because it's badass. That's where you get your custom suits. So that's how I fit that much handsome in those suits, Pecker. Okay, so we don't have too many questions left. Thanks for hanging with me. And in the feedback, that you're sending me. It's really valuable. It's really helpful. People encouraged me to still go off on my tangents. Maybe I've gone too far on them today. Oh, sorry. Somebody also said, please don't slurp into the mic. Did I do that on purpose? I don't know. It's hard. I don't know why. There's something about this cup or sitting this way. I don't know. Sorry. Does the UFC put their young stars in the spotlight too fast instead of letting them develop? So this is what I was talking about. This is what people are fixated on. And with that question, I see Ronda slash Nunes and Holly slash Randami as the UFC's long game for the Ronda-Holly rematch in another double belt fight. Gamble? Question mark. Thoughts? Question mark. And also with that, quick question. Why do you think Nunes is getting no love from the UFC? She is the champ, not Rousey. Do you see how all those connect? See how all those connect? Are they putting these stars in the spotlight? You know, do you think they're trying to get Holly and Ronda rematching for this belts? I'm telling you. And then why are they promoting Ronda? So the last one, Ronda's a big fucking superstar, okay? Big television superstar that transcends the thing. So why are they promoting her? Because that's the most bang for their buck. So that's separate from fighting. I'm saying it without any judgment, with just removing myself back from it, going, why are they doing that? The answer doesn't have anything to do with fights or belts or champs. The answer has to do with if you are going to, let's say, ask Robin Black, let's say 10,000 people watch it. And then another show, ask this inanimate pen on Fight Network on our YouTube channel, gets 500 views. Where would Fight Network be better spent getting buying YouTube ads? This one. Because this, I am more interesting than this inanimate pen. I hope. So that's where you'd spend your money because you'll get more for it. If 10,000 people seem to go, I don't know, this Robin Black guy, he's weird, but I want to listen to him. Well, then you'd be better off to spend the money to attract eyes to something they would watch or listen to that seem to watch. If you put this inanimate pen, it is very nice. It's shiny. It's red. If you put this just here like this is the show now. It's just this pen. How long? Until people don't go. They won't watch that. If you're watching this currently, I am not losing my mind. I'm just having fun. So that's where you'd put that. And what is going to get you more value? So again, please don't think I'm endorsing this or for this in any way. I'm just strictly giving you my observation. This advertising Ronda Rousey on commercials where people who see them go, oh, that's that chick from Ellen. Or, oh, that's that woman, that's that Ronda Rousey. John Oliver had her on his opening credits. Or, oh, that's Ronda Rousey. Man, you see her, when she got kicked in the head, she's back? Or they can put Amanda Nunes and go, this is a nameless, faceless UFC champion that most of you have never heard of. Now, I know that a response to that might be, well, if you spent money on Amanda Nunes, they would know of her, and I'm here to tell you that's actually not true. I know it feels true, but currently there are hundreds of thousands of television commercials about all sorts of things that you don't that don't attract your attention. There are car commercials that you'll see the car commercial go, and immediately after I'll say to you, "What car was that?" And you have no idea. And you know that that television Taster's Choice, you know, or Sanka or whatever other, which one's which? You don't know. Most of us don't know. There is advertising everywhere we look, everywhere. As you walk outside, you don't even notice it anymore. The bus goes by, the cabs go by, they have something, the billboards, it's everywhere. It is impossible to just tell somebody to pay you money to watch Cole Miller fight. I just randomly picked a UFC fighter. It doesn't, and people will discuss, oh, you got to get the promotional push behind all that kind of stuff. That's what's been a lot of questions about today. It will do nothing. The world has so much advertising everywhere for shit you don't buy. Why would you think that if you're not going to have even know what car it was, that if it's some person that doesn't have that little spark, that you'd know who Cole Miller or Amanda Nunes is? You wouldn't. You wouldn't. It's just, you just wouldn't notice. It just doesn't work that way. For some reason, And again, this has been, I know, a theme of the questions that came up today. For some reason, there was something about Paige VanZant or Mickey Gall or Elvis Presley or Axl Rose or Shania Twain, Beyonce, whoever. There's something about them. We don't know what it is, but they're the ones that if you put them on a bus, you will pay attention. And it's true. Advertising is almost useless now because it's everywhere, which is also why eventually Twitter beefs and the same hype eventually has no value. Because the 170,000th time that you've heard the winner of this one gets a title shot, it's not as meaningful. The same thing goes over and over again, and you don't pay any attention. So Ronda Rousey is being advertised because that'll actually make them money, and that's why they do it. I don't know if that's good or bad. That's just what it is. And then the last thought on this, did they put the stars in the spotlight too fast? Do you think this is the long game? I'll tell you honestly, this is the God's honest truth. They don't give a fuck about who's going to win or who's going to lose ever. I'm serious. I know this is counter to everything we think we know, but it's the truth. I've spoken to them directly. Joe Silva in particular. Joe Silva literally never picked a fight, never picked a winner, never. He believes in randomness. He believes in chaos. He's in a strong atheist who has no belief in any, faith or, destiny or anything. And when you say, oh, man, they're going to do anything they can to keep Conor away from Khabib Nurmagomedov, that's so the opposite of the truth, and I'll tell you why. Conor, the biggest money fight that he ever had was the rematch of a fight he lost. These guys are in the business of making money. That's what companies do. That's what their shareholders want. That's what they exist for. That's not, again, neither good or bad. Apple Computers, it does want you to have a good computer. And it does want to make quality things, but its shareholders, at the root of what it is, it's there to make money. And the UFC would be no different than any other company in the world. And the most money to be made is after Conor McGregor loses a fight. We've already learned that. So this idea that, oh, hopefully this happens, is it a risk to try to get Holly Ronda, the likelihood of that happening is so slim. If you put any of them against anybody ever, it's still slim. They have no desire for any outcomes. And so I know this, you don't believe me, but I'm telling you it's the truth. They don't care that Paige VanZant lost because they found it has no bearing. Ronda Rousey, if she fought Amanda Nunes before the Holly Holm fight, it would be about a third of the amount of money that they would make as this one because she lost. It's better. It's more interesting, nobody would have believed that Ronda was going to – everybody would have just known she's going to run through Amanda Nunes if you hadn't seen the Holly fight. And it was just finish, 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 destruction, destruction, destruction. It's like, it'll just be another one. But now that she's lost, I don't know. I mean, can she do it? Everybody wonders. They don't care. They don't care. Sage Northcutt lost. Oh, shit. Mickey Gall won. Paige VanZant, oh, no, she lost. Michelle Waterson won. Now you've got two people they're interested in. They don't give a fuck about the win or the loss, and they can't. And even if once upon a time they did, just put yourself in their shoes for a moment. Just put yourself in Sean Shelby's shoes or Dana White's shoes. For 20 years, imagine for 20 years, they lost. Oh, God. And then, I hope this. Oh, God, no. You would be like, you can't live your life like that. Could you be like that if you put on 5 shows a year? Maybe. But could you be like that for 20 years of running a business, being emotionally, planning things ahead? They can't plan past. I mean, why are some of these fights happening now where there's only 7 weeks' notice or 6 weeks' notice? Because it's really hard to just keep doing these shows. They have no long-term plans. It doesn't exist. It can't exist. It can't exist. And I know that goes against everything people who grew up watching professional wrestling and the stories we like to tell ourselves about, oh man, they're trying to set up. They're not trying to set up shit. They're we're dealing with Saturday night. Okay, Paige and Watterson. Okay, great. Ratings were good. Show was great. Oh, Paige lost. Okay, well, we're going to get her in a rematch with this one. Oh, Watterson won. Oh, cool. Let's see if she can do a main card. Whatever happens, they go from there. And that's the truth. That's the truth. Because they can't do anything else. There's no way. You can't. That's the only thing you can do. Okay, last question. I'll probably ramble after this. Maybe I won't. Maybe we'll wrap this up tight. I genuinely appreciate you guys hanging out with me. I said on the first one that maybe it's like therapy. There's something about working out your ideas, and some of this is what I'm doing. I'm not here to give you definitive truths on things. The more I study myself and the more I study growth and stuff, you realize that facts and truths are still perspectives. The truth doesn't care if you believe it or not. And like gravity, I said, you know, this inanimate red pen, gravity doesn't give a fuck if you think that's gravity or not. It doesn't care. And neither does the truth. But conversation to me is much more interesting. And being wrong, I think, is great. And finding a truth that 3, 4, 5 weeks later, 10 episodes later, I find to be untrue, I think is really valuable. And I think changing perspective, thinking you know something, but with more information, learning something new, that's so powerful. That's what we need to do. We gather more information, and it turned out that, you know, we thought this fighter was doing this for this reason. Now we know them and say, oh, actually, I never even thought of that. You know that. Oh, you're wrong. Good. You learned you were wrong. Take it. Learn something from it. Build on it. You know, there are certain myths and mistruths that we're treating as if they're real, and we're building on those mistruths. And we need to dig in there and find them and get rid of them and find that we are wrong. It's important. It's very important. If I say to enough people that this microphone is evil and it could harm the next person in here, pretty soon hey, guys, you can't go in there. This microphone is bad. If we get that story going long enough, then we maybe build some laws as a society, this office, build some laws against this microphone, and all of a sudden we judge that microphone. We tell everyone, it's just a fucking microphone. So, but we do that. And we need to dig deep into some of these things and find where we're wrong. And I think maybe we can do this here. And early in the year, we're going to try to find the way to be, you know, doing this live, where maybe even off camera or something, we'll have Chase, or maybe we'll put him on camera. I don't know. Maybe. He's sitting there going, I don't know if I want to do that. But he can then feed me. Somehow we can make it so that the questions and answers in real time can become part of the debate and part of the discussion. So that'd be really cool. Okay, last question. I was talking about the Karate Hottie, and so she won. And now people know her. She won on national television. She told a great story about her daughter, the kind of stuff that hooks people still. There'll be a day where that'll be incidental to the rear naked choke or the fight itself or what the moment was like for her or the experience between the two of them. But for now, we're just going to acknowledge that those moments on the microphone still have more influence than they probably should. But that's a reflection on our culture and our interest in the things, the distractions. But yeah, good for her. And so do you see Watterson fighting Joanna Champion in the near future? Ferris from Malaysia. Hey, Malaysia. Malaysia in the house. I don't know why. Like, when I try to do stuff like that, I just seem like such an old man, you know? When I try to, like, you know, do hip-hop and stuff, there are times where I'm just like, man, I'm old. My wife's only 30, and she makes fun of me sometimes. Do you see Watterson fighting Joanna Champion in the near future? Okay, first of all, I don't know if you guys have watched my boardroom breakdown with Joanna. But clearly there's something between us, just so you all know. She's like, I think, right, Chase? Yeah, I think there's some kind of spark there. Yeah, so I don't think I can be unbiased. No, I'm kidding. There was just a moment in there where, like, we were acting out some stuff, and we were talking about pushing down on the head as you grapple. So there was a scene where she was, you know, against her opponent's pressure on the back of the head. And as she was coming in, and I started pushing down on her head, and then immediately everybody made fun of that. Like, as obviously there are logical jokes to make, and my wife was like, "I thought you handled that moment really well." And I honestly was like, "There was no moment. Neither one of us thought anything of that, because if you have ever wrestled or sparred with women, very quickly none of that exists, like at all, you know." And even when guys first grapple, they're like, "I don't know, man, it's going to be weird rolling around with a dude," you know, or you see like those memes of like Shogun and Vanderlei. None of that exists. I've heard, you know, in the odd homophobic environment, "Oh, I don't know if we could have a gay guy in here." It's like, dude, are you serious? First of all, don't be a homophobe. Second of all, you really think Steve right there is thinking about that while you're fighting? Like, you know, and it's the same thing when you roll with a girl. You're a straight guy or a straight girl, and you roll. There is nothing going. There is nothing like that. So in that moment, literally, until people put that on the internet as gags, I didn't notice anything. Well, actually, a couple of the guys in the office were like, "Hey, did you see when you pushed on the back of her head?" But there was nothing. And she's actually brilliant and funny and charming. And yeah, and there's actually nothing between us, but I thought that would be funny to say. I hope they fight. Joanna is like a beast. And, you know, that's, again, now, beast. She's a beast. Where did that come from? That probably came from Joe. I'm going to try not to slurp. It's harder to drink coffee by yourself on a camera than you think. I don't know. It's weird. The beast probably came from Joe, undoubtedly. I mean, it may have come from some other boxing thing or something, but... she's something special, like as a fighter, as a mind, and if you get into range where she can get her hands on Michelle Waterson, that'll be a rough night for Waterson. But that whole playing on the outside with that sidekick, she talked to Brian. I listened to that one with the sound on, and Uriah. I didn't say anything about Uriah. What an awesome, awesome career that guy's had. What a cool – you can look up to Uriah Faber, man. But that side, working that sidekick from out there, that doesn't work against any top 20 fighter in, say, the men's welterweight division. But against a young fighter, that's a really good idea. Something that she's sort of not super familiar. It doesn't happen a lot. That was a really cool idea. That might be a good way to kind of try to keep Joanna out there. But she is just a savage. Again, that's that one's absolutely a Roganism. Savage. Joanna's going to be really hard to beat, but somebody's got to fight her, and I think Waterson would be a good candidate for that. But yeah, last thing, and now that I remembered Uriah Faber, I'd like to, you know, we should all thank that guy for the fights that he gave us and what he did for the lighter weight divisions. He was the very first fight I ever watched, him and Mike Brown with my wife, and that was really cool. And he was always one of my, and still is, one of my heroes. So that's really cool that Uriah had such a great career. And he's still young and successful and handsome and rich. And good for him, man. Good for him. All right, I guess that's it. Please, feedback is very valuable. It's been very valuable, and I really appreciate it. If you only saw episode 1 and today 3, there is an episode 2 that we did on Tuesday. Chase and I just whipped one together because Ramdean and Pollock were out. Please check it out and share it. And thank you so much. And thanks for sharing the podcast. And thanks for the questions and the great ideas. And thanks for your time. Yeah. Blackout.